I'm Jim Pinkerton.
And I'm David Korn.
And welcome to Blogging Heads TV, where the subject for today is David Korn's and Michael Isikoff's new book, Hubris, the inside story of spin, scandal, and the selling of the Iraq War. David, thanks for spending some time with us today.
I'm glad. I hope it doesn't get as feisty as it did last time I appeared on Blogging Heads TV to talk about this book.
Well,
and I have to encourage viewers, if you don't know what I'm talking about, don't worry about it. Don't go back and watch.
Yes, I should tell the massive Blogging Heads TV audience that there was a lively debate between David and Byron York of National Review recently, and I won't attempt to replay the Byron York part of the argument, mostly because I don't understand it, and second, because I'm not sure I agree with all Byron's positions. But David, why don't you sum up a little bit, and then we'll move on to the many other topics, what your sort of take on the whole Armitage business is, so that people can sort of know what, in reference to the previous conversation you had with Byron.
Well, the book first made news when it came out a couple of weeks ago by disclosing for the first time, and with on-the-record quotes and confirmation, that Richard Armitage had been the first leaker, the first source, that is, for Bob Novak's infamous column that disclosed that Joe Wilson's wife, Valerie Plame Wilson, was a CIA operative. And to make this really short, because we went on at great length about this, conservatives have jumped onto this revelation to basically say there was nothing to the case, and the White House, Karov, Scutalibi did no wrong, some even arguing that Scutalibi should, the case against him should be dropped because of this. That's because, their motives are pretty apparent. But what we note in the book, Michael Isikoff and I, is that while Armitage was the first leaker to Bob Novak after Joe Wilson's infamous op-ed piece, at the same time, Scutalibi and Karov were leaking as well. Karov confirmed the leak to Bob Novak, which allowed him to run with the story. And before the story came out, before the Novak column came out, of course, Karov leaked the same information, which is classified information, to Matt Cooper of Time magazine. And Scutalibi confirmed it to Matt, and he also leaked it weeks earlier to Judith Miller of the New York Times. And according to Patrick Fitzgerald, the special prosecutor, didn't tell the truth about that when he was first questioned by the grand jury, and then later when it became first questioned by the FBI, that is, and then later when he appeared before the grand jury. So we've said all along, Michael Isikoff and I, that there were two things going on at once here: Armitage leaking either for his own reasons or because of gossipy reasons, as he claims, and Rove and Libby leaking as part of a campaign to undermine Joe Wilson, a critic of the White House. And, I think it's easy to keep two things in one's mind at one point in time, but some of our conservative friends have wanted to use the Armitage leak to erase all else that was happening at the time.
Although it seems to me like the hero of your book, in a way, if I can be ironic here for a moment, is Robert Luskin.
I don't know if we would put it in heroic terms, but we do go into great details about how he managed to get Karov off the hook and unindicted, because he came pretty close to being indicted. And again, it's a rather confusing tale, but in part, Luskin had a claim. I mean, one issue was there was an email that was incriminating about Karov that wasn't turned over for nearly a year after it had been subpoenaed by the Justice Department and the and Patrick Fitzgerald, and that email contradicted Karov's claims that he didn't remember talking to Matt Cooper and leaking information to him about Valerie Wilson. Well, Luskin's explanation was that, in essence, he, the lawyer, lost the email. And so it was only because of his incompetence, he claims, the email wasn't gathered at the right point in time, and Karov's memory wasn't sufficiently refreshed. And it's a convoluted tale, which I think in some ways was designed desperately to, in the sort of raise the doubt in the jury's mind, or confuse the jury's mind, sort of legal strategy. But I think it might have saved Rove from being indicted.
And it worked. I mean, and Luskin
did work.
a pretty good job of lawyering. I mean, maybe Mark Foley will need him before all is said. But I think it would be a disservice to the Blogging Head audience and to everybody else if they only thought this book was a hash over of the Armitage case. In fact, this is a ambitious, big, fat take on the whole Iraq war and the whole, and including on the ground stuff in Iraq. I think that's what jumped out at me as I was reading through it. But let's just talk about some of the characters I think that mm-hmm. that feature prominently in the book. We talked about our Luskin, Roe. Let's leave that for the previous conversation and right. and all the reviewers and so on. Let's talk about some of the other characters. Let's talk some more about Libby and how you see him fitting into all this, including the larger issue right. of.
Well,
the war,
I mean, the book, as the subtitle implies, is about the selling of the war and the sales campaign. The leak's only important because it came out as a result of a sales campaign that had gone bad. And, the first 60% of the book happens before the invasion of Iraq and long before the leak. And Michael Isikoff and I detail, how the administration was building its sales pitch, primarily in the WMD charge, and the allegation that Saddam Hussein was in cahoots with al-Qaeda. Yet there were disputes upon dispute within the intelligence community and in all the agencies, the DIA, the Department of Energy, the State Department, and, of course, the CIA, over all these facets of the administration's case. And we note that early on, from early 2002 and on, it's well known, it's been written about already, that Dick Cheney was going out to the CIA to talk to analysts and others there about what was happening with Iraq. But also, Scooter Libby was joining him on these visits, and I think the popular perception among those who've paid attention to these stories is that Cheney was kind of leaning on analysts and people to say, give me the right answers, tell me there are WMDs in Iraq. That's not what was happening. What was happening was two things. Cheney and Libby, occasionally joining him, went out to the CIA to keep track of a very ambitious covert action plan that had been devised from the end of 2001, beginning of 2002, to have a tremendous range of covert actions against Saddam Hussein. This included sabotage efforts within Iraq. It included espionage, that is, getting spies close to Saddam's inner circle. It also included what they called direct action. That's a euphemism for assassination, since the CIA was prohibited from engaging in assassination after the Watergate days. The plan also called, and we go into this in great detail in the books, for the training at a secret Nevada test site. No one had written about this before. They brought in dozens of Iraqi exiles. Many had worked for the Iraqi military, and they trained them in part to go in and do these sabotage campaigns, but also to try to mount a provocation to take an Iraqi airbase on the border of Saudi Arabia that would allow, will hopefully draw Saddam Hussein's forces down there through a no-fly zone and would allow the British and American forces that patrol the no-fly zone to essentially start a war with Iraq. So that was part of the plan. So Cheney was coming out there and talking to people at the CIA about that with Libby, but they also were having conversations about WMDs. And what they were doing was, in talking to the analysts, they were asking them, okay, which portions of the of Saddam's army has chemical and biological weapons? How much do they have? Under what circumstances would they use it? How could we defend against this? What are our troops likely to face? This all, as a smart Blogging Head viewer no doubt will already figure out, shows that Cheney was no longer interested in the question of whether Saddam Hussein had WMDs, an issue that had not been resolved by many within the intelligence community, or exactly what he had and what threat was posed by the WMDs. He already assumed they were there, and he was only interested now in the tactical intelligence, how they might be used against U.S. troops, again, assuming, reaching the conclusion already, that an invasion was coming. This is, already a year before the invasion. So the analysts, of course, could only disappoint him because they didn't have clear evidence even indicating what was there, let alone evidence what types of WMDs and in what amounts were with what particular Iraqi military units. So he would be very, he'd be, he, you know, he would be a little more engaging and friendlier with the guys running the covert action plan. But he was very tough on the analysts because they weren't giving him the information that he wanted, which was, you know, what to do about WMDs should there be a war.
And so was Libby just tagging along? Was he following orders? Was he giving orders?
Libby was tagging along. And many people told us who, when they were in meetings with Cheney and Libby, Libby tended to be deferential to the vice president, standing back at the side behind him, and would let the vice president, who in some ways is his own action officer, do the talking. But in between those meetings, Libby was sending literally dozens, scores, hundreds of requests to the CIA. Give us more information on this. Give us more information on that. Cheney and Libby were actually looking at raw intelligence reports, and they were doing this later on. We have some good stories later on about the WMD search. They were looking at raw intelligence reporting about WMDs and sending follow-up questions to the people at the CIA. Now, you know, this is, you know, in some ways to be commended. I mean, as you know, having worked in the White House and worked around Washington, people at the top often don't get involved in the details. But what they were doing, which becomes apparent throughout the book, is that they weren't looking at the sum of the intelligence. They didn't believe the CIA was good at drawing conclusions. They were suspicious. They came out of this tradition, the neoconservative and conservative. Donald Rumsfeld was part of this. People of conservatives around Washington who were suspicious of the CIA, believing it didn't fully see the threats out there with the Soviet Union or with ballistic missiles. And they kept creating Team Bs to challenge the CIA's assumptions. And Cheney and Libby were doing the same. So they weren't looking at the intelligence at large. They were looking for bits and pieces that they could then say, aha, CIA missed this, they missed that. And they would keep peppering the CIA with requests of that nature. And as you might suspect, Libby in particular came to be looked on at the CIA with low regard. And we found many a person who would use the most profane language in describing him because, you know, he wasn't accepting their findings. He was peppering them with requests to find the little tidbit that they could use to undermine the full assessments of the CIA.
So, in that vein, who is Lori Milroy?
I should ask you. Do you know Lori?
I've met her a few times. I've seen her on. I mean, I've seen her on TV more recently than I've met her.
Right.
I haven't seen her on TV much lately.
I don't say that to put you on a spot, but
no, it's quite all right. I remember being struck always that she was a strange creature.
Right.
Let's put it that way. And I think she's so strange that they've knocked her off TV. I mean, I'm sure she's not on TV, not because she doesn't want to be, but because they won't let her appear. But you go ahead.
Well,
you've written the book.
Well, that could be. I mean, this is chapter 4 of the book. And, you know, a lot of people still ask the question, what drove us to war? There are a few new tidbits, but only a few, actually, in Bob Woodward's new book, State of Denial. But in our book, we try to explore it as far as we could get. And, you know, it was quite clear that neoconservatives, this is no secret, it's not even a conspiracy, you know, for 5 to 10 years had been pressing for military action, U.S. military action against Iraq. You know, Bill Kristol and the Project for the New American Century, they've been, you know, putting out openly public letters to Bill Clinton and to others, other presidents, that would be George Bush, of course, to do something about Saddam, and by that they meant military action. Trying to figure out all their motives has been a difficult task. We're sorting and separating all them out. A lot of people point to, you know, their fondness for Israel and an affinity for the Likud hardline position of Israel and that taking out Saddam might help there. The question of oil, but what we found was, at least in Wolfowitz's case, and he wasn't, you know, the number two guy at the Pentagon, and from the day after 9/11. Was advocating war with Saddam Hussein, even rather than against the Taliban in Afghanistan, but that he had become enamored of this theory, and the only thing you can call it really is a conspiracy theory, developed by Lori Milroy. You asked who she was. This is a long-winded way of getting there. She was a Harvard-trained academic. What we discovered, published for the first time in the late 1980s, she was actually a Saddam apologist. She was writing articles with Daniel Pipes, another hawk on Middle East issues, calling for the U.S. to back Iraq in the fight with Iran. But beyond that, that was public. She had a secret diplomatic effort that she was mounting backdoor diplomacy between Tel Aviv and Baghdad, trying to create a quasi-peace accord between Israel and Saddam's Iraq.
You know, I think you have it that she actually traveled to Baghdad.
Yes, she went to Baghdad. Right, she held meetings, and she carried messages back and forth, and it was her position that Saddam Hussein could become a benign or perhaps even positive influence in the region. He was not, remember, he was secular. He was not Islamic. And, you know, he had to worry about Iran. You know, she was thinking that Saddam and Israel had a common interest in being opposed to Iran. And
did Lori think that Saddam Hussein would become a small D Democrat?
Well, actually, she wrote one article for the, I think it was for the Jerusalem Post, an op-ed piece, in which she said no one should poo-poo some of the democratic initiatives that Saddam had taken in the late 1980s. You know,
I miss those.
I miss them, too. I'm sure there were laws passed, you know, calling for this or that. But a Saddam apologist is probably a nice way of describing what her position at the time. And but then, August 1990, when Saddam invaded Kuwait, she turned on the dime, and she did so with the vehemence of someone who felt personally betrayed. You know, a sexist might say a woman scorned, so to speak. And she immediately, you know, came to see Saddam as a evil figure, wrote a book with Judy Miller about Saddam that was a bestseller that wasn't as harsh as people might have thought now, and not as gung-ho for the war that George H.W. Bush, who you served, started. Was kind of cynical about that war, saying it was based on oil politics. But then, in the years after that, that was 1991, she started writing and then ended up writing pieces and ended up writing a book that said, and this is literal, I'm not making this up, I'm not exaggerating, that practically every act of terror in the world had emanated from Saddam Hussein, that Al-Qaeda was essentially a puppet controlled by Saddam Hussein. The 1993 World Trade Tower attack, the attack on the USS Cole, the bombings of the American embassies in East Africa, all of it was, even if mounted by Al-Qaeda on the surface, was planned, engineered by Saddam Hussein. And you know, the evidence she had, you know, is really stuff out of a grade B movie. Stolen identities, double fingerprints, and the important fact is, I mean, we go into it in the book, but people's eyes may glaze over if I try to go through it here. The important thing is that the CIA and the FBI at first took her ideas seriously and did examine her charges, allegations, and look at the evidence that she had to bear, and decided that there was absolutely nothing to it. She was saying one person was another person, and the FBI had fingerprints indicating that one identity belonged to two people. So, you know, they had hard evidence. They didn't buy what she had to say, and they continued to debunk it. What is important for our story here is that the neocons, Paul Wolfowitz, Richard Perle, Jim Woolsey, who was a Democrat but still in the neocon camp, Scooter Libby, and other less well-known neocons endorsed her book. Paul Wolfowitz wrote the blurb on the back. And they really believed that Saddam was continuing the first Gulf War through these series of terrorist actions against America, to the extent that three days after 9/11, American Enterprise Institute, a think tank that is the home to a lot of these neocons, maybe you. Have you ever been affiliated with them?
No, I have not had the privilege.
Good for you. Although, you know, I'm sure they pay well. And they had a press briefing 3 days after the 9/11 attacks, and Gene Kirkpatrick was running it, the former UN ambassador. Newt Gingrich was there, Michael Adeen, a well-known fellow at the AEI, and Lori Milroy, who wasn't that well-known. And they picked on her to make a presentation first. And she really said that Al-Qaeda are keystone cops. They couldn't have pulled this off. The real culprit had to be Iraq. And as we now know from our book and from the 9/11 Commission and other sources from Woodward's second book, maybe first book as well, that immediately after the 9/11 attack, Paul Wolfowitz and others are saying Iraq was probably involved in this, and we should, you know, look at attacking Iraq. So Lori Milroy really gave some of these neocons who had a geostrategic, I think, reason for wanting to confront Saddam Hussein militarily, you know, sort of a, you know, a backstory, but a, you know, a casus belli. You know, it's one thing to say, well, let's look at the Middle Eastern region, and if we can take out Iraq, this will happen and that will happen. You know, the American public, you know, may not go for that. But to say that Saddam Hussein was behind all these attacks and then was involved in 9/11, well, my, that is a reason to go to war, and they hung on to it to the bitter end.
As you look back at this, that section of the AEI speech a couple days after 9/11 is you've got a long quote from Milroy there about, you know, obviously Bin Laden couldn't have done this, it had to be Iraq, especially now that we know that the Iraq regime was much more of a, you know, Keystone Cops operation. I mean, there's obviously a pretty substantial resistance inside Iraq right now, but it doesn't appear to be too particularly linked to Saddam loyalists. I mean,
well,
it
appears
to be.
We actually know now from the recent Senate Intelligence Report put up by the Republican-controlled Senate Intelligence Committee that there was no links, no operational working links between Baghdad. I should say no evidence of. No one has found any evidence of any of these operational links between Baghdad and al-Qaeda. You know, there have been a few meetings, as, and I'm sure, you know, intelligence services around the world had different meetings with al-Qaeda representatives. Many of these were years before 9/11, and people like Stephen Hayes at the Weekly Standard and others have tried to knit whole quilts out of these few contacts. But we know, you know, the evidence, the 9/11 committee, commission and intelligence committee, it's not us so far. But anyway, I interrupted.
Well, I agree. And the point is, it's hard to even argue that Saddam Hussein was really even in control of his own country. I mean, he obviously was an evil dictator,
right.
but he didn't control the southern part of the country. He didn't control the northern part of the country. I mean, he sort of, I mean, it's unclear what he was doing other than staying in power and torturing people in his own little fiefdom there. I mean, but stepping back for a second, since you've obviously, and Michael Isikoff written this, you know, massive book, did they just, I mean, and you make it sound like it when you have Bush, I think you've got a quote in there from somebody saying, I've never seen anybody less surprised than George W. Bush about the no WMD evidence. Did they just sort of wake up or show up in office on January 20th, 2001, saying we're going to do this?
You know, I think there was a desire, amongst, you know, Paul Wolfowitz and Donald Rumsfeld, Dick Cheney, a lot of the neocons, and I don't use that as a derogative term, but I think there was a desire. I mean, they had been agitating for this for years, and by writing a blurb and endorsing Lori Milroy's book, Wolfowitz was essentially saying that Saddam Hussein had been attacking America for years. And if that's your belief, well, then I assume you want to do something about it. You might recall that Richard Clark wrote about the first deputies meeting, as they call it, of sort of the deputy secretaries at all the various agencies on terrorism in the Bush administration. It was, I believe, April 2001, and Clark starts going on about the threat from al-Qaeda. It had gotten worse, and it was something that had to be dealt with by the new administration. And Wolfowitz just shoots him down and says, who cares about this little man in Afghanistan? Saddam Hussein's the problem here. So they came in believing that and wanting to do something about it. You know, where Bush stood at that point in time, you know, is a little bit unclear. He talked about, you know, sending a message to Iraq, a strong message, particularly about WMDs during the campaign. We have a scene after, it's now obviously after 9/11 in May 2002, when he's at the White House one day, it's May 1st, and in the middle of the day he's taking a break and he's hitting tennis balls to his dogs on the back of the White House lawn. And he asked Ari Fleischer, the press secretary, and Adam Levine, who's a press aide, what happened in the press briefing today, boys? And Ari Fleischer tells him about a testy exchange that Fleischer had with Helen Thomas, the gadfly reporter, in which she was saying, it looks like we're heading to war with Iraq. Why? What's the reason? He's a tyrant, but there are lots of tyrants. He's a bad guy. What makes him so different? Why do we have to go to war? And Fleischer kind of fenced with her for a little while, then moved on to somebody else. And as he tells Bush this story, Bush gets very steely and interrupts and starts cursing a blue streak. And he says, "You, I guess I can say this. On a lot of shows I can't, but I can use the actual words. You tell her I don't like motherfuckers and I'm going to kick his ass all over the Middle East." And he went on in that vein, cursing and cursing. And it showed, I think, a very visceral, passionate hatred of Saddam Hussein. And as you and I would agree, there were a lot of good reasons to hate Saddam Hussein. Genocidal maniac who tortured people. Well, he should be hated. But I think we all want our leaders to make dispassionate decisions about where to go to war. And I don't believe we'd see Bush talking about, say, the tyrants of Burma, or the people who, were behind the Tiananmen Square massacre in those same terms. There was something about Saddam Hussein that, brought out this visceral reaction within Bush. We have other examples of this in the book. And, people can do their own psychoanalyzing here. Was it, the finishing his father's job? Was it showing that he could do something his dad couldn't do? I tend to think, and this is just a hunch, I don't even put this in the book, I don't think we put it in the book. If so, it's just a slight reference. That I think that after 9/11, in addition to anything else, he felt a very proactive need to go out and, attack the enemy. Al-Qaeda, they're in 60 different countries. They're like cockroaches. You can't take a machine gun and blast away at them. Saddam Hussein, he's a sitting duck. He's a bad guy. There's bad blood. And he's easy to demonize. He's a problem. WMD issue was a problem, not a threat, with Saddam Hussein. And I think Bush felt providentially he was in this position now. He had to protect America. And he had to show the world that he could do that. And that meant finding the people to take out. Saddam Hussein was easily number one on that list. And there were plenty of people around Bush who, for the reasons we've just gone over, were, had given him a context in which to make Saddam Hussein the issue.
I think that phrase context reminds me of there's a phrase the Israelis came up with called concepcia, which is the term they used in their own analysis of what went wrong on the 1973 Yom Kippur War, where they convinced themselves that the Egyptians could never attack, never launch an assault across the Suez Canal. And since they knew that the Egyptians couldn't do that, they didn't worry very much about such an attack. And then, of course, then it came, and Israel was nearly defeated, at least for the first little bit there of that war. And so that notion of conceptia being to coin a phrase, paradigm, if you will, that's so strong that you can't get out of it and that it simply locks in all your thinking, it does make me want to ask, does the scene in the Woodward book, which of course everybody's talking about now, the scene where Richard Clark and George Tenet and Kofor Black go to see Condi Rice in July of 01 and say, hey, we think there's an Al-Qaeda attack coming, and it would appear that Condi Rice, who was then the National Security Advisor, didn't do much of anything, or if anything at all, about it.
Yeah.
Would that fit into the model of, hey, the issue is Iraq, not Osama bin Laden and Al-Qaeda?
A couple of different responses here. To begin with, on the particulars of that, I spoke to a former intelligence officer today who was close to those who were involved in that meeting, and Tenet and this former official say that it wasn't Tenet's impression at the time that he was being brushed off by Condi Rice. He thinks that Woodward has overwritten this portion. The meeting did happen, and if you look at the Washington Post today, there's a story that notes that Tenet talked about it, testified about it to the 9/11 Commission, and in his testimony he doesn't say anything about being dismissed. In fact, I believe he says in the testimony that the 9/11 Commission, that Condi says you got to talk to Rumsfeld and Ashcroft about this as well, and and took it seriously and said that she would have other people look at it. So in some ways, I think that, I'm not here to, at this point at least, to pick at Bob Woodward's book, but I do think that there are a couple of things that I've come across in the book in which I think there's some hyping going on.
That leads to an interesting question.
But let me just finish the point.
Okay, yeah.
Which is not to say that Rice and everybody in the administration were in sync and you know, and in line with what should have been, we know now in hindsight, the right way of thinking. You know, they were still months behind on the Al Qaeda business. We know about Bush being briefed the next month. President's daily briefing saying that Bin Laden wanted to have a strike within the U.S. And so I think that was the mindset. I think for a couple different reasons, there was focused more on Iraq and they hadn't really gotten their heads around this new idea, and that the Rice meeting on July 10th with Tenet and Kofor Black was a part of a string of meetings in which, this was talked about, yet it didn't lead to direct action. Not that she dismissed it and ignored it, but nothing happened commensurate with what Tenet and Black were saying. And I'll give blogging head readers a little scoop here. Tenet's, has a new book out. It's, he has a new book that he's written. It's gone to the Publication Review Board, I believe, at the CIA, and it's due to come out early next year, and he promises to describe this period in great detail, at least his side of it.
So just a couple of questions. Since we do have a blogging head audience that we want to take seriously and take into our confidence, and so if you can say naughty words to the blogging head audience and not get in trouble, perhaps you can take us a little more inside as to how ace reporters like Michael Isikoff and you and Woodward operate. In that May 2002 meeting that you referred to a little while ago, you said, okay, there's George Bush, right, and Ari Fleischer and right, Adam Levine.
Right.
Were you there?
No.
Was anybody else there? Was just the three of them?
It's just the three of them, and this is Adam Levine's account.
Okay, so that's what I'm saying. So you're willing to, Adam Levine.
We name him in the book. One thing I'm really proud of with this book is that we have a lot of people on the record as much as we can. And in that instance, and in some other key instances, we do have, the whole business about Armitage being disclosed as the first source of Bob Novak, we had that from unnamed sources, but we also had a named source, Carl Ford, who was head of the intelligence division of the State Department, who told us about the time Armitage confessed to him that he was the leaker. So, I read Bob Woodward's books like everybody else, and often you can tell who the sources are. But, often it's, so-and-so walked out of a room and had a thought, and you don't know, and he doesn't attribute it, but it's obviously talking to that person. We try as much as possible to put people on the record. You can't do that all the time. And we have extensive notes in the back in which we list our, the people we interviewed and documents and describe to the extent we can the unidentified sources.
Okay, gotcha. Let's talk about this business, about this attempted sabotage war in Iraq. I think it was called Anabasis, if
Anabasis,
I have the name right.
Yes.
Anabasis, yeah. A couple points. One, a little bit more detail on that, and then second of all, what implications does the success or failure of that particular mission against Iraq 3-4 years ago, or 4 years ago, more like, speak to whatever we might be doing about Iran, because we keep reading from Seymour Hersh and others that we're already, and Sam Gardner, who's an Air Force retired colonel, was on CNN or MSNBC the other day saying this too, that we're already conducting military operations of some kind in Iran, which sounds suspiciously similar, if true, to what you're describing in Iraq. So describe a little bit more of what happened, and did we get our money's worth out of these people, including a character who I'm sure you'll get to in a moment, Ahmed Chalabi.
Yeah, well, again, in reference to your previous question about sources, we spoke to one of the two men responsible for the Anabasis plan, we have him by name in the book. His name is John McGuire. He was deputy chief of the Iraq Operations Group of the CIA. Having him on the record, I think, is a pretty major, scoop for us. And but the important thing that he points out in the book, and he pointed out to us time and time again, was that when he cooked up Anabasis with the chief of the Iraq Operations Group at the direction of George Tenet, who was being directed by the CIA, by the White House, it was never considered to be a substitute for military action against Iraq. It was considered to be a complement or a prelude. They were to go in there and establish, you know, do some sabotage campaigns that could help, if there were to be an invasion, create espionage operations, you know, intelligence units, spying units that could be used if there was an invasion, assassination campaigns that could knock off people before and during an invasion, to create, at the time of invasion, conflict and chaos within Iraq. So it was never devised as a substitute. So the fact that it was going ahead, and the fact that Cheney was being briefed on it, you know, day in, well, not day in, day out, but regularly from, you know, early 2002 on, shows, and we have evidence of this in other places, that the Bush administration, far earlier than they would admit publicly, was indeed committed to war in Iraq. Now, I assume they allowed for the possibility that Saddam might leave or something might happen, war wouldn't come about, but they were working towards war from the, you know, from the end of 2001, when Bush asked Donald Rumsfeld to start drawing up plans. So Anabasis, as I noted earlier, too, even included a plan that would lead to an act that could be used to start a war, the taking of an Iraqi airbase. So the question then is, you know, this was not considered to be, you know, a cheaper alternative or a quieter, more covert alternative to war with Iraq. So what does that mean for Iran? Iran, of course, now is a much larger country in size and population. I think everyone would say that the military there is much stronger than the military was in Iraq. The government, the regime there is probably solid. You know, there were people like Richard Perle and others before the Iraq War who were saying that, you know, you put 20 troops inside of Iraq, 20 American troops, and everything will crumble. Turns out that wasn't the case, but certainly the Iran government regime presents a much harder, more solid target. So in that instance, it's hard for me to envision how even a massive covert action campaign that has paramilitary components, and this one, you know, Anabasis, I think, got budgeted to the tune of $400 million, but how a campaign of that sort would make a, you know, a tipping point difference in Iran.
Well, let's go back to Iraq. Did it work in Iraq?
Well, no, actually. Well, you know, actually, it didn't. In the end of the day, I think they were geared more towards getting a war started. They mounted some sabotage efforts. They knocked down some power towers, and they blew up some train tracks. They knocked off. They killed some people, I think, close to the Kurdish territory. So they developed some sources inside Saddam's regime, but actually the most important ones came about in a separate program. So, you know, it didn't do a lot of damage. It didn't do a lot of harm to the U.S. efforts, but it ended up being kind of a flea on the back of the elephant that was the U.S. military invasion.
Gotcha. But that does suggest, by this logic, and let's be careful here because we don't want the blogging head people to get more panicked than they should about the prospect of war with Iran.
Right.
That if the sabotage campaign is not, as you say, an alternative to war, but a prelude to war, then if there's a sabotage campaign going on in Iran right now, right, as some people allege, and maybe your reporting has I'll let you speak,
right,
then maybe that, by that reckoning and that logic, Operation Iranian Freedom has already begun. We're just in an early phase of it. Is that possible?
It could well be, and it could well be that, you know, that they're still drawing up military plans, and they're, you know, setting the stage for that possibility. You know, they may decide that it will take a year or two before things are at a place in Iraq where war with Iran can happen. They may just be ignoring what's happening in Iraq. I mean, you can really, any way you can imagine this is a distinct possibility, which makes it hard for reporters, because, you know, you find one or two sources who say, yeah, this, you know, A, B, C is happening, and, you know, people probably even inside the national security establishment will draw different conclusions about what that means for the long run. I was at a conference with some folks who have insight into, you know, connections with Pentagon people these days, and they believe that Iran, that a decision's been made, and that, you know, for a military encounter with Iran. Now, it may not be an invasion. It might be a, you know, bombing campaign. And you could have covert action programs that are in sync with that. You know, people come in who can be spotters, people who could do, you know, blow things up at the same time as the bombing campaign. You know, there are, you know, there are Iranian opposition groups. Perhaps, you know, they're trying to, you know, bolster them in a way. I mean, you can, you know, knit together all sorts of things here. So it doesn't mean, you know, that if something covert is happening in Iran, that a big major ground war is on the drawing table.
If we do go to war against Iran, based on your reporting, because he's a major figure in the book, which side would Ahmed Chalabi be on?
Well, that's going to be a really hard question, because, you know, the whole, you know, we get into this, Iran's influence on our path to war, I think, is more pronounced than a lot of people realize out there. Ahmed Chalabi, for those blogging head viewers who have been asleep for the past 5 years, was the head of the Iraqi National Congress, a group of exiles who didn't have, as we said at the time and as people now know, didn't have any real support inside Iraq. Yet he became the darling, again, of neoconservatives and others, including my old friend Christopher Hitchens here in Washington, who promoted Ahmed Chalabi as a pro-Western bourgeois fellow who could, you know, turn Iraq into a, you know, a pro-West, pro-Israel democracy in the middle of the Middle East. And one could write a whole book about how the Chalabi connection, you know, screwed up U.S. policy here. The INC, his organization, fed numerous defectors who claimed to have information on Iraq's WMDs and Iraq's connections to al-Qaeda terrorists to people within the government, but also, probably more importantly, to the people in the media, including Judy Miller. I don't mean just to point her out, but Jim Hoagland at the Washington Post and others at the New York Times Post, people at front lines at PBS and Vanity Fair and British newspapers, who tell these horrific stories of Saddam having WMDs. They all were wrong. And the intriguing thing is that the fellow in charge of that part of the INC's program was a guy named Aras Habib, an Iraqi, who was, from the mid-90s on, suspected by some within the CIA, we quote them by name in the book, of having been an Iranian agent. So wait a second, think about this for a moment. A guy bringing forward false defectors, peddling propaganda that would encourage America to go to war in Iraq, was an Iranian asset? You know, that would raise the prospect that Iran, Iranian intelligence, was, you know, working through the INC, through the neocons and through Cheney's office and through American media to sway public opinion here to lead to a war against Iraq, against Saddam Hussein, who, of course, the Iranians wanted out of power. It's pretty profound a matter that it certainly hasn't been investigated by any official bodies. Here I'm looking across the street at the Senate as we talk. And, you know, at one point when I was told this by John McGuire, a CIA officer who I talked about earlier, who worked with Chalabi for years and came to suspect his aide, Habib, was working with the Iranians, I said, I don't understand. How could this be? How could you know not raise a fuss? How could this not be an issue that goes up to the president? The INC might have been infiltrated by the Iranians. And he just kept saying, you don't understand. I go, what do you mean? Why did you say something, John? I would say to him. He goes, you don't understand. You can't fight City Hall. Meaning that because the INC was so, you know, taken and supported and embraced by the White House, particularly Vice President Cheney's office and the Pentagon, particularly Paul Wolfowitz, you know, no one would listen to anything about them. So the guys at the CIA, on matters regarding INC, literally gave up.
So where is Chalabi now?
Excuse me?
Where is Chalabi now physically?
Well, I think he's in Iraq. I mean, he ran for, you know, he went back and he went back to Iraq, and he, you know, thought he'd be the next president. He got a few jobs in the interim governments, became deputy prime minister and oil minister at some point in time. But then at the last round of elections, his party got less than 1% of the vote. And he lost his jobs in the government. And we really haven't heard from him since. People watch and say, never count Ahmed Chalabi out. It's interesting that there was an investigation. There were allegations, leaks that came out of the U.S. government, that he had actually handed over U.S. secrets, particularly about U.S. being able to read Iranian codes. He turned that information over to Iranian intelligence. Condoleezza Rice and others promised there'd be a full investigation of him and of this, and that investigation never really seemed to happen.
So is he an Iranian? And we know about Habib, or at least we think we know about Habib. Should people come away with the impression that Chalabi is also an Iranian agent?
His interests and the Iranians were one and the same, and they both wanted to get rid of Iraq. He had a home, and the INC had an office in Iraq for a number of years.
In Iran, excuse me.
A lot of Iraqi, you know, opponents of Saddam Hussein found aid and comfort in Iran. So clearly there was closeness, there were ties. What the degree of his relationship with Iranian officials, Iranian intelligence, if he had, an official relationship has yet to be determined. Although, he was charged, and, officials in the U.S. government, in the Bush administration, did leak to numerous reporters in town that he was suspected of having turned over secrets to the Iranians. Condoleezza Rice publicly promised an investigation, and one never really materialized.
So maybe he's spying still for both the Americans and the Iranians, and he's got friends everywhere.
He is a wheeler dealer. He was convicted in absentia of defrauding his own bank in Jordan of $300 million. He sent these fraudulent defectors to Americans and the media to influence and sway the public debate so that we'd be in favor of a war that would presumably serve his interests. I would, without casting any specific aspersions of the nature you raise, I would say I would put nothing past him.
You mentioned a moment ago Christopher Hitchens, and you called him an old friend. I assume he's an old friend from your days together when you're still on the left, and he was once on the left, and who knows where he is now.
Well, we shared an office together about 25 years ago at The Nation magazine when he first came over from England.
I didn't know you went back that far with him.
Yes.
Explain him to us, please. And is he or any of the neoconservative bunch at all sorry, apologetic, defensive? But first Hitchens, and then the larger question of any reassessments they might or might not have had in the last couple of years.
I've been asked many a time since Christopher, defected from the left and came out in support of the war and went and started running around calling Wolfowitz, a genius. My guess... Oh, I should have turned off my phone. Hold on a second. Apologies to Blogging. I'm on Blogging Heads TV right now. I'll have to call you back. Bye.
Bye.
See? Gotcha. That happened.
Folks, you know you're getting the raw stuff here. This is not an overproduced slick TV show at all.
I can't say we're going to edit that out because we don't edit. But that was the wife, and that's why I keep the phone on, because you never know when there's an emergency. But actually, the other day that happened to me when I was on the Diane Rehm show on NPR, and I quickly turned it off. And the good thing about it on the radio is no one sees you fumbling for it. But she told the funny story afterwards off air, that when she was interviewing novelist Tom Wolfe, and in the middle of the interview, the phone rang, his cell phone rang, and he picked it up, he answered it, and while in the middle of the interview, he said, "I'm sorry, I can't talk right now, I'm being interviewed on NPR." In any event, Christopher Hitchens. It's a long, as we like to say, it's a long discussion what's happened to him. I will self-reference an exchange that I had with him recently on Slate, And thanks to the wonders of blogging heads, we can put this citation right up here if I'm pointing to the right side, or there if I'm not. And it was about some of his writings on the pre-war handling of the intelligence and on the Leak case and so on. He'd taken a shot or two at me. I responded back. I think I got the better of the argument, but people can judge for themselves. But in that debate, in that exchange, I told a story which I think is kind of symbolic of where Christopher is these days in terms of his reasoning. And that is that we had had a debate last February for the NPR station in New York City, WNYC, and the debate was, the question was, were we misled, that is, misled into war? And for most of the debate, he didn't address the question. Instead, he talked about why the war was a necessity, and he gave all his reasons for that, fighting Islamofascism and so on. But the moderator kept saying, but the question is, were we misled? And finally, he addressed the issue of the missing WMDs. And he said, people, think for yourself. Look at it. You know, we went in there, we found zero WMDs, none whatsoever. I would say that's so suspicious that it's just to me that the crime scene has been tampered with, that the fingerprints have been wiped. And I said to him during the debate, well, you're saying, Christopher, because there are no WMDs, that's evidence to you that there were WMDs. And in the piece I wrote, that he believes he has the intellectual powers to turn absence into presence through his wonderful deductions. And I think at some point one has to be reality-based and come down to earth. And it was quite shocking to me that he would make an argument of that nature. And I think he is just so bought into this cause and is likes to feel that he's fighting a fight against Islamofascism, that he is cutting lots of corners when it comes to arguing the case for war and evaluating, evidence and the set of facts put before us. And as I note in the Slate piece, I sadly consider this, one of the casualties of the Iraq War.
So he's not in any sense apologetic or...
No. He is, that was the other part of your question. He is defiant. He is combative. Jim, you follow this as much as I do, and I ask any of our blogging heads, compatriots, who've been on, who appear with us or who watch us, part of the blogging heads family, to give me an example of somebody somewhere, who was a neocon, who was a cheerleader for the war beforehand, who said, "Whoops, I got it wrong. Whoops, I'm sorry. Whoops, maybe we needed more troops. Whoops, I was wrong," as Richard Pearl said, that we only needed 20 to 40,000 troops at the beginning. "Whoops, I was wrong to dismiss the post-war challenge by saying we'll be greeted as liberators. Whoops, I misread the intelligence." I mean, there is absolutely none of that. And what bugs me beyond that is that not only is there no one being apologetic or, for getting things wrong, the very same people are out there giving us advice on what to do now in Iraq, or worse, what to do in Iran or Syria, and they have the exact same platform. You get access to the op-ed pages. They get called on by the cable talk shows to come and tell us what to do now in Iran, when virtually, everything. It wasn't that just they made a mistake here and there. Everything they said about Iraq, from their characterization of the threat beforehand to what they said was necessary to do the job, to their dismissal of the post-war challenges, what would be necessary for planning after the war, everything they said was wrong. And yet,
no argument for me. I think the one name that comes to mind as somebody who has at least
I know who you're going to say, but go ahead.
Francis Fukuyama.
Yeah, yes. In fact, he has, and he was at this conference I was with, and he's a fellow of yours at the New American Foundation,
right.
And I just spent time with him this past weekend. It was the first time I'd ever really met him, and found him very engaging and thoughtful and quite realistic about where he had been and where he is now, and I found that rather refreshing.
Okay, so we're running out of time here, unfortunately, but we have a few more minutes. But one figure we haven't really talked much about, and we should, and you've done a lot of work on him, is George W. Bush. Mm. And you know, speaking of apologetic or not apologetic or learning lessons, I mean, just talk more about what you think, where you think he is now, and what you think lies ahead in the remaining 2 years of his presidency.
What I find, you know, what we talk about in our book, and I see a couple of scenes about this in Woodward's book, but though not a lot. I mean, Bush and Cheney are not front and center in Woodward's book. It's basically, you know, his story basically is Rumsfeld is a prick and ruined the war for everybody else. But what I found in all the, you know, all the firsthand accounts we had of meetings with Bush and so on, by and large, showed that this was not a guy who asked questions. He didn't ask questions about the WMD intelligence. I mean, in corporate terms, he did no due diligence. You know, when there was reason to know that there was some intelligence in dispute, he and Condi Rice, who should have been pushing him in this direction, never called people in and said, let's see, what is the disagreement at hand here? Let's see who's right, who's wrong. He didn't do that. And on the pre-war planning issue, he barely asked any questions about what's going to happen after he invaded the country. Even if after Powell said, you know, you bought it if you invade it, he showed no real interest in what would happen economically, security-wise, socially. How do we get in it? You know, how do we fund this? What countries are committed to doing this? A complete lack of curiosity. We have a couple of scenes in the book when he, you know, he does ask one or two questions of what happens next, and Tommy Franks says, well, we're going to appoint Lord Mayors, you know, these sort of quaint British title, in cities throughout Iraq to take care of things. We talked to the guy who was in charge of post-invasion planning for the Third Army. He said he never even heard of that idea. And Bush just sort of shrugs and says, well, okay. Doesn't ask, what does that mean? You know, who's in charge? Who's funding this? What else? Is that all what you're doing? And Woodward has a couple of scenes like that. You mentioned a scene earlier we have when David Kaye briefs him the first time. You know, he's told that there aren't going to be WMDs found. This is in the end of July 2003, a few months into the invasion. And Kaye tells him this in the Oval Office, and who's there? Wolfowitz and Rumsfeld and Cheney and Libby and Condi Rice, they're all there. And Kaye gives him the bad news that maybe they'll find some production capacity, but no stockpiles. Bush doesn't ask him anything. Well, are you sure? Have you checked here? Do you need more money? Do you need have more resources? You know, what does this mean? What were they doing? He just kind of says, what else do you need? And Kaye says, I just need patience. I'm not done yet. I want patience. And Bush says, I have plenty of that. Kaye walks out of the office, says to himself, I've never met anyone at this level of government so uninquisitive. So, and then, you know, that brings us up today. This is a fellow who all along has not asked the right questions or the hard questions and has never sort of had anyone come in and seem to challenge him, and he's stuck. He's stuck in a hole in Iraq, and he can't stop digging, and there's no good answer. Staying, putting more troops in is an ugly situation. Taking troops out might lead to an ugly situation. It's unclear if there's any good being done at this point in time. We'll probably leave it for another day, a conversation between you and I, about what should happen in Iraq. And we may even agree, for all I know. But from looking at it from the vantage point of the White House, I thought Bush's, you know, book was going to be Woodward's new book was going to be called Bush at Sea, in that he just doesn't seem to have a grip, and he hasn't had the tools that you'd want a commander in chief to have going into a difficult elective war. He's good at the fortitude, and we're going to, you know, win, you know, type of, you know, put the calcium in the backbone, as he put it in Woodward's last book, you know, attitude that a leader might need. But in terms of going through the intellectual thought processes that you want a leader to go through when making these commitments and then trying to figure out how to solve these problems, it just doesn't seem to be there. And I'd really be curious whether you agree with me on that.
Well, I definitely think that Bush learned a lot from AA, from Alcoholics Anonymous, or whatever equivalent he was in, which is, and this jumps out from the Woodward book, the earlier ones, you have a plan, you stick to it, right. And that's kind of reassuring to people. It's reassuring to yourself, and you simply never deviate from it, no matter what. You never touch a drop of alcohol again in your life.
That's why people call him a dry drunk.
I'm sorry?
That's why some people refer to him as
a dry drunk.
Right,
but it's a kind of, it's a discipline and a structure that gets you through life and gets you elected president. The upside of structure is rigidity, and the downside, of course, is rigidity. If you have to change and you can't change,
right.
I mean, it's puzzling to me over what President Bush is thinking. If he says we have exactly the right number of troops, maybe a few thousand more here and there, but right. Exactly the right number. I mean, you know, every issue of the Weekly Standard has got Bill Kristol writing an editorial saying, you know, we've got to send more troops, we've got to send more. We're not possibly going to win unless we, you know, send a whole bunch more. And, you know, after the election, maybe they will. You're probably a better, you know, student of this stuff than I am in terms of what they're likely to do next. But if they just stay where they are, according to the plan, then, as Tom Friedman says, they're simply babysitting a civil war, which I guess could go on for a while. I mean, like another couple, maybe a couple years, maybe even longer than a couple years. Who knows? But I think it is a case where Bush's fidelity to the plan has cost him the chance to think creatively about this. And therefore, I wonder, and we're almost about to wrap up here, what you think of whatever Jim Baker might come up with his Iraq study commission forthcoming.
You mentioned fidelity to the plan. One problem was there was no plan. You know, that's just, you know, there was an impulse. There was an idea. There was a notion. There was really no plan. And that is what has come through clear in all of Woodward's books. We get into that in some details in our book too. And to me, that's the, you know, we can argue to the cows come home whether Bush misled the country on the WMD stuff and the Al-Qaeda Saddam connection. I think I have a pretty persuasive argument. But putting that aside, there's no question that he and the people who are in charge of this elective war, again, you can't get away from the fact that it was elective, it was chosen, not thrusted upon us, didn't have a plan for what to do. They had presumptions, assumptions. They thought they knew that things would just bounce their way. That's why we called our book Hubris. That's why we did that, because they put their assumptions and presumptions ahead of, you know, known sets of facts and ahead of other people's expertise who all predicted the problems that would happen, and they just felt they knew best. They knew best. And so so now, you know, we're you know, you create, you know, Bush's, you know, it's helped Bush politically that he created a problem for which there is no good solution. So anybody criticizes him, they can say, well, what's your solution? Oh, that's not a good solution. Of course not, because there is no good solution. You know, it inoculated him a bit in the presidential election last time around, and still helps to this day. Allows him to say, well, you just want to cut and run, as opposed to stay and fail. But you asked about the Jim Baker Commission, which is being co-chaired, I believe, by Lee Hamilton, and they're supposed to come up with ideas. Yeah, it seems to me the 90% probability here, you know, looking at, you know, the history of presidential commissions, is that they're going to come up with a lot of foreign policies, mumbo jumbo about, you know, setting these goals, striving for this, you know, trying to bring in other countries, and, you know, and propose something that, you know, sounds good in the abstract. But they're not going to, you know, call it a failure. They're not going to say, you know, they're not going to do anything like you have to pull out or you must do this by 6 months. And it will be kind of a mishmash. There is a slight chance, and it's maybe 10% or less chance, that they may come out and say, we failed in Iraq. We have failed in Iraq, and now we need to figure out a way to deal with that failure. Here are a couple options. If that were to happen, and again, I don't think it would, the irony would be somewhat delicious. It would be Jim Baker, the man who was the head of foreign policy for Bush's dad, who a lot of the neocons and Bush aides, you know, turned against, with, you know, and his advice, turned against his advice in going into Iraq this time, would be coming in and saying, you know, the voice, speaking as a voice from the father, you've messed up, son. You didn't follow, you know, the guidelines and the rules that we set, that we adults set up. And now we're telling you it's time to rethink anew. And we're here to help.
David, I think that's, we're going to have to stop here. Yeah. I think you, there's two interesting points here. One is, I think, and we can pick this up in some future Blogging Heads thing if we could, if we're lucky enough to be asked back to beyond Blogging Heads, you know, if they can afford our high rates for this appearance. Yeah. And that one is, I think Baker will be more creative than that. And two, I think that the Oedipal feeling that Bush 43 has towards Bush 41, there's whatever the Greek word for Oedipalness toward your father's advisor. Yeah. I'm sure there's something in there we can talk more about. David Korn, author, co-author, along with Mike Lysakoff of Hubris, thank you very much for being on Blogging Heads TV.
Thank you, Jim.